quarter. We're picking up at 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 7. And I'm going to tell you ahead of time, I have a clergy meeting today, so I'm going to get as far as I can get, but it's going to be a little shorter today than we usually are. Because the bishop calls, and you know how that goes. So, chapter 10, verse 7. And we are now getting into a chunk of the letter where Paul is defending himself against opponents. And we'll talk in more detail about the opponents as we get to different chunks of them. But he's defending himself against other people. And so, as is typical, excuse me, of Paul, he gets a little passive-aggressive when he does that. So look for that as we're reading some of Paul's character. It's one of the ways we know that this, other than dating and other things, that this letter is authentically his, because it's got that style that is him, you know. It's like with any writer, you know, when you read Jane Austen enough, you get a sense of how she phrases things and the way that she deals with topics. Paul is the same. So picking up at verse 7. Look at what is before your eyes. If you are confident that you belong to Christ, remind yourself of this, that just as you belong to Christ, so also do we. Now, even if I boast a little too much of our authority, which the Lord gave for building you up and not for tearing you down, I will not be ashamed of it. I do not want to seem as though I am trying to frighten you with my letters. For they say, his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech contemptible. Let such people understand that what we say by letter when absent, we will also do when present. We do not dare to classify or compare ourselves with some of those who commend themselves, but when they measure themselves by one another and compare themselves with one another, they do not show good sense. We, however, will not boast beyond limits, but will keep within the field that God has assigned to us, to reach out even as far as you. For we were not overstepping our limits when we reached you. We were the first to come all the way to you with the good news of Christ. We do not boast beyond limits, that is, in the labor of others, but our hope is that, as your faith increases, our sphere of action among you may be greatly enlarged, so that we may proclaim the good news in lands beyond you without boasting of work already done in someone else's sphere of action. Let one who boasts boast in the Lord. For it is not those who commend themselves that are approved, but those whom the Lord commends. So, a little bit of context here. Paul is saying that, hey, we were the first to come to you, and he's using really the royal we here. I suppose if you pushed him to the wall and tickled the bottoms of his feet, he would say that the we includes Titus and Timothy and Barnabas and some of the people with him, but really, the for we read me. But what he's doing here is claiming, I'm the one who brought the good news to you. I'm not boasting about work that other people did. And there's a hint there that maybe the people who are telling the Corinthians that they don't have to listen to Paul are building up on his work, you know. Say, hey, I brought the good news to you. I came to you first. I'm not building on anybody else's work. And the kind of unspoken part is, unlike them, right, who are building on my work. But the other thing that he's doing here is a little bit of a backhanded thing at James and some of the leaders of the church in Jerusalem. where, particularly where he says, and I'm picking up at verse 13, "We, however, will not boast beyond limits, but will keep within the field that God has assigned to us." So he's talking about, you know, I only went where I was supposed to go. I didn't go further than God told me to go. As opposed to kind of the church in Jerusalem, which is like, hey, why are you in? Why are you preaching to the Gentiles? So he's saying, I went where God told me to go, and I only went as far as God told me to go.
I thought he had an agreement with James and Jerusalem that he should go out to Gentiles.
Yes, but that happened after he went to Corinth.
Oh, okay.
So,
he's referring territorially, not...
Yes, yes, territorially. Physically, when he says our sphere, he's talking about physical space. And so when he says, you know, we want to... So at verse 16, so that we may proclaim the good news in lands beyond you. You know, we want to get you settled, then we can go further. Once you're you're there.
Are there other people like Paul, though? Not the people from Jerusalem that who were out there preaching?
Oh, yes. And we're about to hear about some of them.
It sounds like they're competitive, and they want to, in that, you would think as Christians, they'd be working together and not...
Remember that this is very, very early in the Christian story. We're still only about 30 years after the resurrection. So what is the good news of God in Christ is still open to question. And there are still groups of people who say Jesus was a prophet. He was the latest in a line of prophets. You should listen to him. There are those who say Jesus was the Messiah. There are those who say that Jesus was a son of God, just like the Greek gods have lots of sons, but not the only son of God. Who Jesus is and what Jesus' message is still open to a lot of debate. We've talked about it, even between Paul and Peter and James, right? There's debate about what it means to be a follower of Christ. And Peter walked around with Jesus his whole ministry. James was his brother, and Paul, you know, has seen him. You know, he appeared physically to Paul, and the three of them are debating. So, you know, go a circle out further, and there's more.
But with the people you just mentioned, you would think that they would agree upon the fact that Jesus is the Messiah. You know, and they were preaching the same gospel.
They agree that Jesus is the Messiah. It is not at all true that they are preaching the same gospel. James is still preaching that you have to become a Jew in order to be a follower of Jesus.
To be circumcised.
And yes, and follow all of the law.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So even in the inner circle,
okay,
there are debates. Go a layer further out, and there are even more. And also because, as you know, having read a bit of the Bible yourself, it's not like Jesus gave roadmaps, right? Jesus' teachings are not entirely clear all the time. And remember that at this point, there really are only loose collections of teachings, and mostly oral, not written. Only a few things have started to be written down. So it's not like you can go back to the Gospels, the authoritative source, and say, but this is what is written here. And even if there were, I mean, we have those today, and there are still lots of different ways I'm interpreting that. So
I think you have to give James a lot of credit because it's extremely difficult for a family member mm-hmm. to acknowledge that kind of greatness
mm-hmm.
at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. James is the one who held together the apostles and the church, while Paul and Peter left to their own devices, probably would have splintered into two different groups. And James is the one who held them together. So, you know, that's... He gets some credit for that, too, because if without him, it is unlikely that Christianity would have really survived.
In what way?
Well, if Peter and Paul had separated, and there becomes two different groups, who both of whom think they're following Jesus, what happens when groups divide like that is that they turn their energy to fighting each other to prove that they're the right one. And had they done that, when the destruction of Jerusalem happened in 70 AD, there wouldn't have been a strong enough base in either camp to really survive the pressure of being the enemy of empire.
Are you saying just by James teaching, just by teaching he held them together?
No, just by James's authority of saying, as the brother of Jesus, you both are going to be part of this community, and we're going to stay together.
We need more churches named St. James.
So,
question on verse 10.
Mm-hmm.
It says, for they say, quote, his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech is contemptible.
Mm-hmm.
In what way would his bodily presence be weak?
We don't know what Paul looked like, except for a few references like this, that he was maybe not a very tall person, that he was not much to look at.
Okay.
And there is a lot of speculation that he may have had a stammer, because he refers a couple of times to him not being able to speak well. So he's apparently more impressive in writing than he is in person.
So. Yeah, he has such a strong personality that you assume his his persona, his physical persona, will also be impressive.
Yes, but apparently not, because that reference comes up a couple of times, that he wasn't that impressive in person.
Okay.
And of course, a part of this is him feeling sorry for himself. Of, you know, I can't do anything right.
So kind of an insecure person in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, I think Paul has a little bit of what we would today... Sorry, did my internet freeze?
Yes.
Okay, start over. I think Paul has a little bit of what we would today call the imposter's complex. That he doesn't feel like maybe in the deep depths of his soul that he doubts he maybe really belongs, and so he overplays it.
You don't think this is false modesty?
Maybe a little bit. That's certainly a part of his...
But he took advantage of his background and his education and his family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, probably because he wasn't one of the original disciples.
Mm-hmm.
He feels a little bit...
Yeah. So, you know, and that's perfectly understandable if you think about him as a human, right?
Mm-hmm.
No. And
that seems to be a pattern of the people that Jesus calls to represent him, though, people who do have either human failings or
some
kind of inferiority. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Thank goodness.
And not just Jesus, God. If you look through all of Scripture, the people God calls are almost never the people who, you know, the HR department would have put first on the list. God always picks people who have failings and foibles and problems and... You know, and I think that there's a reason for that. I think it's to show us that God, if God can, for heaven's sakes, if God can make David a great king, what can he do with us? Right?
Exactly.
You know, if God can make Peter the rock on which the church is built. What can he do with us? Right? All right. So let's see here. We're going to pick up at verse 11. And we're just going to do the first four verses. Chapter 11, verse 1. I wish you would bear with me in a little foolishness. Do bear with me. I feel a divine jealousy for you, for I promised you in marriage to one husband to present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. But I am afraid that as the serpent deceived Eve by its cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes and proclaims another Jesus than the one we proclaimed, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you submit to it readily enough. So I'm stopping there, even though it's the middle of the paragraph, because the introduction of the super apostles, I want to put off. So Paul is saying, hey, you know, I'm the one who told you about Jesus, but you seem to be drawn away by other gospels and people talking about a Jesus other than the one that I told you about. Why are you doing that? You know, a little bit of woe is me and a little bit of, you know, you're better than this in there. So, and now he's about to talk about the super apostles. Now, let me talk a little bit about this before I read it. We're not really sure who these super apostles were, but they were very charismatic, apparently, and apparently the gospel that they were preaching was enough at odds with what Paul was preaching that he felt the need to stand against them. We're not really sure who they were or what they were preaching, but there's a lot of speculation that they might have been Gnostics. Gnosticism is a heresy that started very early in the church and continues to this day. You see it coming out even today. The idea is that while what Jesus publicly preached and proclaimed is all well and good, that there was a secret knowledge, gnosis in Greek, which is where Gnostic comes from. There was a secret knowledge that he shared only with a small group, and only a select group are permitted to carry it on. And so there's a suspicion that the super apostles that Paul's talking about are people who came claiming to be holders of this secret knowledge of God, and that they would decide who got it, who was good enough to be admitted into the secret knowledge. And as every cult leader throughout history will tell you, this is a very powerful enticement tool, that only you are smart enough to really know what's going on. You know, there's only a few of us that really can see what's going on. There are only a few of us that really can read the secret signs, right? Everybody else is just sheep. They just follow what people say, but we can see within it and see the real truth. Does this sound familiar? It's, you know, it's happening today. That's the whole basis of QAnon, is I'm going to show you, but only special people, what's really happening. Right? So, this Gnosticism is ancient and modern. It's hasn't gone away. And it pops up in the church a lot. through history. This idea that there are, you know, special people who have secret knowledge that can't be shared with everybody. Alright, so I'm picking up at verse 5 to read more about the super apostles. I'm going to go through verse 15, and then that's where we're going to have to stop. Okay? I think that I am not the least inferior to these super apostles. I may be untrained in speech, but not in knowledge. Certainly in every way and in all things we have made this evident to you. Did I commit a sin by humbling myself so that you might be exalted, because I proclaimed God's good news to you free of charge? I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you. And when I was with you and was in need, I did not burden anyone, for my needs were supplied by the friends who came from Macedonia. So I refrained and will continue to refrain from burdening you in any way. As the truth of Christ is in me, this boast of mine will not be silenced in the regions of Achaia. And why? Because I do not love you? God knows I do. And what I do, I will continue to do, in order to deny an opportunity to those who want an opportunity to be recognized as our equals in what they boast about. For such boasters are false apostles, deceitful workers, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder. Even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So it is not strange if his ministers also disguise themselves as ministers of righteousness. Their end will match their deeds. So Paul is throwing it down here, right? Saying, hey, look, I didn't take anything from you. Now, forget about the fact that he had just been asking them for money for the church in Jerusalem a few chapters earlier. But his point is, when I was there, I didn't take any money for myself. Right? I didn't ask you of anything for myself. As opposed to, apparently, the super apostles who are asking for contributions to support them from the Corinthians. And that makes sense. It's one of the first things that would happen is, hey, if you want in, you gotta pay, right? And so he says, you know, look at the difference. I didn't take anything from you for myself as opposed to them. And then he says, it's no wonder that they're claiming to be apostles of Christ. Even the devil claims to be an angel of light. Why wouldn't his followers do the same? So Paul is obviously very upset by these dudes. And they are dudes. I mean, that's clear. So
he's finding a lot of different people, not just people who are teaching legitimately, but then this group as well.
Yes. Within what we would call the church, right? The true followers of Jesus, there is division. But then outside of that group, there are others who are claiming to teach the gospel of Christ, but are not.
But even the legitimate ones, especially the well-known ones, they all ask for money. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, and like I said, Paul is staking his claim here that I didn't ask you for anything.
Exactly.
But a few chapters before, he's asking them for money. So
you money
for asking for himself. He's asking it for the church, right? In Jerusalem.
Right. That's right. And that's the distinction he draws, is I'm not asking for it for myself.
No. Okay.
I'm asking for it to aid others. And of course, I'm sorry?
You see it now. I said, you see it now, some of those mega churches asking for so much money, and they're buying, you know, their pastors are buying airplanes, or they're living lavishly. It's a different kind of support.
Well, and there's a line there, right? Because I come out in stewardship every year and say, hey, we need your pledge if, you know, you want the church to be here, if you want me to have the time to do things like prepare and teach Bible study, and that costs money. So, we, you know, it's always a fine line of where is the line between we need you to help support what we're providing and asking for too much. And you got to be very careful, because it's very easy for church leaders to use guilt and other kinds of manipulation to get people to part with money they shouldn't part with. It's one of the reasons that in most mainline churches, and in the Catholic Church too, it is unethical for clergy to receive bequests to them as individuals from parishioners. So, you know, I'm not allowed to have people leave things to me personally in their will. That's unethical. You can leave it to the church, but not to me. And those are the kinds of ethical lines we try to draw of, you know, if you want to support the church, support the church. That's a good thing to do, but don't.
The church needs to support you.
Right. And my salary and benefits are the largest chunk of the church budget. I mean, let's be true, you know. And that's true for most churches, you know, that the pastor's salary is the largest single expense.
Yeah, but it always seemed wrong to me if the pastor has a salary that allows a lavish lifestyle, but the parishioners don't have a lifestyle.
Right.
And even I personally don't think they should have a lavish lifestyle either, because, you know, like Linda said about these mega churches, some of the people having millions and stuff. I mean, that's
but it's all subjective. You know, one person's idea of lavish is entirely different from somebody else.
Except that I think we all would draw the long and the fine at having a private airplane.
Yeah, nobody needs a private airplane to proclaim the gospel. I mean, I'll stake a claim there. Nobody needs a private airplane.
Your parish is not typically that large.
Yes.
I was just going to say, your congregation is pretty costly. Yeah.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, although I will say, the Bishop of Nevada had a private plane before she became bishop. Catherine Jefferts Schori, who was our presiding bishop for a while, was the Bishop of Nevada. Before she became bishop, she had a pilot's license and a private plane, and she did use it to get around Nevada, because Nevada's big.
What does the term presiding bishop mean?
In the Episcopal Church, we have a house of bishops where all of the bishops from all of the dioceses get together. Literally, the presiding bishop is the bishop who presides over that house. That's where the title comes from. The presiding bishop is also the primate, which is the head bishop of the church. So he's the one who oversees, or she, if it's been a she, is the one who oversees.
The gentleman called Curry?
Bishop Curry is our current presiding bishop. Yes.
Okay.
It's a position elected by the House of Bishops and confirmed by the House of Deputies, which is the House of General Convention that is made up of clergy and lay people, priests and deacons and lay people.
Do you desire to become a bishop?
Absolutely not. It's a terrible job.
All administration.
Well, you get all the, you know, you deal with all the problems and you don't get to do stuff like this.
Yeah.
So, it's like being a principal. You know, if you like teaching, being a principal is a terrible job. Because you almost never get to see the kids. So, all right, I think that's a good place to stop. We will pick up at verse 16 of chapter 11 next week. We are getting close to the end of 2 Corinthians. There's light at the end of the tunnel.
We're getting close to Lent.
We are getting close to Lent. So.
Reverend Vicki?
Mm-hmm.
as I researched it, a word that keeps coming up, and I don't know what it means. It's S-H-O-L-E, and I don't know what that means.
S-H-O-L-E, shoal. It's usually without the E, or sometimes the E is put before the O, so sheol. It's a reference to an early idea of hell.
Okay. It's come up several times while I'm reading my Bible, and I didn't understand what the word meant. I thought maybe it was grave or something, but hell fits what they're saying.
Yeah, but it's an early concept of hell. Less of a kind of a permanent condition and more of a transitional state, but that's what it's referencing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I will see you all next week. Have a good week.
And you too. And have a good birthday.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good to see everybody.
Yes, very good.